From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I strive to be part of the membership of the American writers, along with Emily Dickinson, along with Wagner, along with Sandra Cisneros, along with Amy Tan, along with, you know, I don't want to just be sociology, a great Latina writer. Let's read this writer to get a sense of Latinos. Hey, let's read this writer to understand the human heart better.
Author Julia Alvarez talks about her books and life. We go to the Congo to speak with a member of the UN team investigating human rights abuses and caught in the web of drug laws, a rally against mandatory minimums. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from the Washington Post today, former Democratic National Committee Chair Donald Fowler testified repeatedly yesterday that he has no recollection of telephone calls that a Central Intelligence Agency official said Fowler made on behalf of a Lebanese-American businessman who he had been warned had a background, quote, full of significant financial and ethical troubles. During a full day of increasingly skeptical questioning by Republican members of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, Fowler provided low-key answers, almost in a monotone, as he insisted that he had no memory of ever talking to a shadowy figure who was identified only as Bob of the CIA. Yesterday's hearing, part of the committee's investigation of campaign fundraising improprieties during the 96 election cycle, focused on Roger Tamraz, a major Democratic Party contributor who was seeking support from the Clinton administration for a plan to build a $2.5 billion pipeline to carry oil from the Caspian Sea region of Central Asia to Western markets. Fowler, who now teaches political science at the University of South Carolina, was directly involved in some of the most controversial aspects of the 96 Democratic fundraising practices, and his testimony was eagerly anticipated. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright embraced Israel's demand for a Palestinian assault on, quote, terror today at the start of a Middle East mission meant to breathe life into crippled peacemaking. Albright, who was meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, launched her first trip to the region in office with what she called a straightforward message from President Bill Clinton of support for Israel's security. With just one day of campaigning to go before Scots decide in a referendum whether they should have their own parliament, opinion polls today point to an overwhelming yes vote. Scots are being asked two questions, whether they want their first parliament in almost 300 years and whether they want it to have limited power to set taxes. Opponents of the proposed parliament believe that giving Scotland even more say over its own affairs will put it on a slippery slope to independence from Britain. The Clinton administration has suspended deportation proceedings against five Irish Republican Army veterans who have settled in the New York region and one in St. Louis, saying that letting them stay in the country, quote, could contribute to the peace process. The administration will also not begin proceedings against three Irish citizens who live in Queens, New York. More than 1,000 Zapatista rebels and their backers yesterday ended the first leg of a march to Mexico City to drum up support for an Indian movement they say the government has long ignored. After leaving their stronghold in the southern state of Chiapas for the first time since their 94 rebellion, more than 1,000 brightly dressed Zapatistas and hundreds more supporters arrived in a convoy of 40 buses to neighboring Oaxaca State. Hundreds of Zapotec, Mixtec, and Huave Indians, distinct from the mostly Mayan Indian Zapatista movement, turned out to deliver a warm welcome to their comrades in the coastal town in Mexico, about 340 miles southeast of Mexico City. The Indonesian foreign minister says that Indonesia can consider releasing East Timorese rebel leader Xanana Gusmao, being held in an Indonesian prison on a 20-year jail sentence, but only as part of a comprehensive solution in the occupied territory. The foreign minister, named Ali Alatas, was reacting to pressure from South African President Nelson Mandela, who said yesterday East Timor should be granted self-rule. The Clinton administration wants law enforcement officials to continue having full access to patient medical records. No federal laws restrict access to and the disclosure of patient medical records now, but several bills have been introduced in Congress to provide them as such information is becoming increasingly available through computer networks. The administration recommendation to be made to Congress this week comes as the Department of Health and Human Services attempts to balance privacy concerns with the need to investigate fraud and abuse use in both government and private health insurance programs. Accepting the argument that teenagers would stay away from health clinics if forced to tell their parents, the House of Representatives has defeated a measure requiring parental notification before minors can receive contraceptives. The House voted yesterday. It was a loss for conservatives who have tried, largely without success, to put their mark on an $80 billion spending bill to pay for labor, education, and health programs in fiscal year 1998. Paula Jones's new legal team will receive no extra time to prepare for her sexual harassment lawsuit against President Clinton, even though her two top lawyers quit and a third said he planned to do the same. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The on-again, off-again UN human rights mission in the Central African country of the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly known as Zaire, was declared on-again this week by President Laurent Kabila. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said yesterday in Switzerland he'd received a letter from Kabila confirming his commitment to the UN team. Congolese officials have long sought to limit the mission. We now go to Kinshasa, Congo, to speak to Reed Brody. Reed Brody is one of a three-member team authorized by the Secretary General to investigate alleged human rights abuses in the Congo. Reed, why don't you start off by telling us what happened this weekend?
Well, President Kabila has informed the Secretary General this weekend that the commission is free to proceed with its investigation. He did specify a couple of very important limitations on the investigation that were not in the original agreement with or in the original terms of the Secretary General. He said the investigation should be limited to the east of the country, which is only one of the theaters that we would be looking at. And he also let it be understood that he considered that we could not look at events that took place after May 17th or when he took power.
Can you explain what it is that you've been mandated to do by the UN?
Sure. The Secretary General has asked us to investigate allegations of serious human rights violations or violations of the laws of war that have occurred in the last 4 years in the Congo, what used to be called Zaire. Originally, the investigation came about because of reports of atrocities committed by Kabila's troops on their way to power in their march to overthrow the dictator Mobutu. At the Congolese government's insistence, at the Kabila government's insistence, the inquiry was moved to include events taking place over the last 4 years, particularly in ethnic conflicts in the east of the country.
I would imagine that there's some anger on the part of Laurent Kabila and his supporters that the UN didn't move in under Mobutu. How many years was he there? 32 years of a brutal reign. And when Kabila comes in, that's what they do.
Yes, and we feel that a lot here, and I think it's a point that one has to give them. The United Nations has not, to say the least, been always consistent in which violations it investigates, when it imposes sanctions, when it condemns. Nevertheless, there are very serious allegations of massacres of Hutu refugees in the Congo, in what used to be Zaire, by troops loyal to Kabila. And those investigations need to be looked those allegations need to be looked at. The government, actually, this came about because the government, well, it actually came about because the UN special envoy, the special rapporteur on Zaire, Roberto Garatón, a wonderful Chilean lawyer, went to the eastern part of the country in March at a time when it was already controlled by Kabila's forces, and reported that there were allegations of massacres of Hutu refugees taking place, and recommended that a full-scale investigation be conducted. The Human Rights Commission adopted a resolution calling for that investigation, but then the government of Kabila, by that time in power, blocked the investigation, saying, among other things, that Garatón had already made up his mind. As a result of that, and negotiations between the Secretary General, U.S. Ambassador Bill Richardson, and President Kabila, the Secretary General dropped Roberto Garatón in a move that was highly criticized by human rights organizations, and appointed a new team to investigate. And that's the team of which I am one of the three members.
Now, the head of your team is Mr. Kofi. Can you explain who he is and why Kabila has also protested his participation in this investigation?
Sure. There are three members of our team. The chairman is Atsu Kofi Amega, who is a former judge of the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court of Togo. The government has objected to his presence because they say that Togo is not a neutral country because Togo maintained close relations with former President Mobutu. On the other hand, the other members of the three of us is from Zimbabwe, which has very close relations with Kabila.
And you?
And me.
And who do you have close relations with?
I have close relations with the human rights community, which is actually why probably one of the reasons that I was selected.
We're talking to Reed Brody, who is one of a three-member UN investigative team who is in Kinshasa, Congo. They are there to investigate human rights abuses, the possibility of massacres of Hutus by the Kabila forces as they were coming across the country and taking over from Mobutu. Can you tell us now exactly what these allegations are and when Kabila and his forces, or Kabila or his forces, were alleged to have done this?
Sure. This, I think, with the historical context here has to begin with the genocide that took place in Rwanda when the then Hutu government slaughtered hundreds of thousands of ethnic Tutsis, a slaughter that was only stopped when the Tutsi-led Rwandan Patriotic Front took power in Rwanda. The losing side, the genocidaires, as they're called, the people who committed the genocide, the former Rwandese army, as well as the Interahamwe, the Hutu extremists, took refuge in eastern Zaire. And in those refugee camps, took refuge there and controlled the refugee camps on the border of Rwanda. The Rwandan government said to the international community, look, these refugee camps are being used as bases for the Hutu extremists who are going to come and attack Rwanda. And if you don't do something about it, we will. In late last year, the Tutsi forces, backed presumably by the Rwandan government, launched attacks against these refugee camps. At that point, a coalition was formed, led by Laurent Kabila, which marched across the country from the east to the west to take power in Kinshasa. Along the way, however, they are alleged, and that's what we're investigating, to have carried out massacres in several places of, well, tens of thousands of Rwandan Hutu refugees.
Now, wasn't a large number of Rwandan Hutus just deported from the Congo?
Yes, this week, the Congolese government forcibly repatriated, I think it was 600 or 700 Rwandan and Burundian Hutu refugees in a move that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has vigorously condemned.
How will that affect your investigation? Would they have in any way informed it?
Well, these are people, of course, who many of whom have witnessed the events that we are charged with investigating, and who presumably we would have spoken to, and who we can still speak to. I should add that our investigation is not limited to interviewing people within the borders of what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So you're saying you could go find these people?
We can go find these people, and in fact, today, part of our team left for the Republic of Congo, Congo Brazzaville, across the river, to interview refugees there who were witnesses to some of the events we're investigating.
In fact, isn't there fighting going on in Brazzaville right now in the other Congo?
Yes. Yes, as fact from our base in Kinshasa, we can hear the two sides in the civil war in the Congo Republic shelling each other.
What will you do with the information, Reed Brody, once you gather it?
We will submit a report to the Secretary General. We've been asked to determine the facts and try to establish responsibility and submit a report to the Secretary General by the end of this year. And then presumably the Secretary General will either inform the Security Council, presumably he will make the report public.
Reed Brody, human rights lawyer, one of the three leaders of the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, speaking to us from Kinshasa about the investigation. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to a story a little closer to home, and it's the issue of mandatory minimums. Federal drug laws require that a first-time offender caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine receive 5 years in prison. A first-time offender with powder cocaine would have to possess 500 grams to receive the same sentence, even though the two drugs are pharmacologically the same. Today in Washington, D.C., congressional, religious, and civil rights leaders will be rallying for legislation that would eliminate the disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentencing. Also attending the rally will be a group of high school students who've traveled all the way from Ohio to protest the case of a 24-year-old African-American student named Kemba Smith, who was sentenced to 24 years in prison for her peripheral role in a drug conspiracy involving her old boyfriend. And we're joined right now by Kemba's father, Gus Smith. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why don't you start off by telling us Kemba's story?
Okay. Kemba Smith, my daughter, who we think we did a very good job raising her. She was active in the church, active in the community. She also played in the band for 4 years, ballet, all the things that we thought would nurture her in terms of bringing her up to be a very productive person. She finished high school and went to Hampton University.
In Ohio?
No, Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia. She fell in love with this young man, Peter Michael Hall, who was posing as a student. He was out on the block every day. A lot of kids on campus thought he was the man. He dated a lot of young girls at Hampton University. As a result, he was into a drug business. He was a drug kingpin, as she later found out. But she was so deep into it in terms of his control over her. He physically and mentally abused her to the point where she had to go to the hospital to be treated. She was fearful of him because he killed his best friend. He knew where we lived, meaning her mother and father. He had been to our house for Christmas dinner. Very articulate, well-mannered, well-dressed, driving a Honda, blended right in with the family on Christmas night. But we did not know that he was a drug kingpin. And Kimba was fearful that he might hurt us or even kill her if he killed his best friend if she didn't do what he did. However, Kimba never sold any drugs. She never touched any drugs. These are words of the federal prosecutor, and it's a part of the court record. But she should not be in prison right now. And she will be the first to tell you that as the law is written, she did break the law, but it's not justified.
In what way?
In what way? She provided a automobile to Peter Hall. She put a car in her name. She also put an apartment in her name. And as the law is written, she also dropped off some money to an attorney for him. And as the law is written, this makes her a co-conspirator. And as a result, she is charged with the same amount of drugs that he was charged with, even though she didn't meet him until 4 years after he was in the business.
Well, Gus Smith, we're going to continue the story after the break. Gus Smith, father of Kemba Smith, who is now in jail for 24 years for her peripheral role in a drug conspiracy involving an old boyfriend. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from California to New York, from Maine to Florida, from Hawaii to a number of cities, from Minneapolis to Boulder, Denver. And by the way, if you have a friend who lives in a city that doesn't hear Democracy Now!, just tell them to call their local radio station, public radio station, and they'll be able to possibly get it on the airwaves. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're here talking about the story of Kemba Smith, because today in Washington, D.C., there will be a rally. It'll include people like activist Dick Gregory, Maxine Waters, John Conyers, and others. This is leading up to the Congressional Black Caucus weekend that's happening over the next few days. And one of the stories that people will hear about is the story of Kemba Smith, 24-year-old African-American student from Hampton University in Virginia, sentenced to 24 years in prison on some drug charges. Joining us, this is her father, Gus Smith. And Gus, you just told us about how she got involved with this guy who ended up being a drug kingpin. Why did she rent the apartment, get the car? Did she know what he was using it for?
Initially, she did not. And later, her involvement with him, she fell in love with him. Kim is a very loving, compassionate person, always trying to help. Then the beating started, the threats to me, to Kemba, and like I said, he killed his best friend. So she knew if she didn't do what he asked her to do, that he could very well kill her.
So he was arrested and she was arrested?
No. Kemba turned herself in when she found out she had been indicted. And later, after she had turned herself in, Peter was murdered in Seattle, Washington. And after that point, they still kept her in prison and would not give her a bond. In spite of the fact that initially when she turned herself in, they wouldn't give her a bond because they felt that Peter was a threat to her life. And they needed to keep, the only way they could keep her safe was in jail. But then he was killed and they wouldn't give her a bond.
And what happened in the courtroom? How did she end up being sentenced to 24 years in prison?
She was sentenced to 24 and a half years in prison because of mandatory minimum and the way the laws are on the books. And it basically, the law says if you help anyone in any way, in any fashion, in a drug enterprise, that you can be charged with the same amount of drugs as the drug kingpin is charged with. Even though you never sold any drugs, you never may even seen any drugs, but you will be sentenced based on the weight of the drugs, which is actually calculated by the Justice Department.
We're joined on the phone right now by Anthony Graham, who's a teacher at the Colonel White High School in Dayton, Ohio, leading a group of students to Congress today. He just arrived in Washington to protest mandatory sentencing guidelines. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you coming in with this group of students to Washington? What do you have to do with Kemba Smith?
Well, actually, our involvement is simply I read the article in Emerge magazine. And what I did, I had my students to do a homework assignment, which was to read the article and write a 5-paragraph composition on what they've read and how they feel about the story.
The article in Emerge Magazine was called Kemba's Nightmare, A Model Child Becomes Prisoner in Drug Sentencing Frenzy.
Exactly.
And what'd the kids say?
Well, actually, after we read the story, the students wanted to get involved some kind of way to help her situation, which I had never been in this type of forum before. I had no idea what to do, so I talked to a couple of social studies teachers, and they basically said, well, maybe you should start a letter writing campaign. And that's what the kids did. They started writing various media, Congress people, and they also wrote U.S. Attorney Janet Reno and our Congressman Tony Hall.
And now they decided to come to Washington.
Right. They felt through the local media back home, they did get some attention for what they were doing, but they felt that they were not being heard. So they wanted to take it as far as they could. And I still cannot believe I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. about a story that began as a homework assignment.
Well, we're also joined on the phone by Monica Pratt, who's the National Project Director of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which seeks to reform mandatory sentencing laws on a federal and state level. How did you get involved with this whole issue of mandatory minimums, Monica?
Well, I've been working for Families Against Mandatory Minimums for about 4 years now, and my personal experience dates back to my childhood when at age 7, my father went to prison for a year for a marijuana offense. It wasn't a mandatory minimum because the laws weren't enacted at the time. What's happened, and this is why Kemba is in prison for so long, for so little, is that in the 1980s, members of Congress, in order to address the growing problems of the war on drugs and the crack epidemic that was sweeping the country, went into action and enacted a series of laws known as mandatory minimum sentencing laws. These laws basically, they set the punishment on the weight or the alleged weight of the drug involved. That's why Kemba was sentenced for the full amount of drugs that Peter Michael Hall had trafficked, even though she didn't even know him until many years after he had gotten involved in the business. With these laws, what has happened is that judges do not have the discretion to fit the punishment to the crime. They can't consider the individual facts of the case or the role of the offender in the case. It has changed our justice system, the enactment of these laws, because now federal prosecutors or prosecutors on the state level have the ability to determine how much drugs are charged, whether or not to accept substantial assistance, whether or not to cut a deal. And so essentially the justice system as we know it has been turned on its head by the enactment of these sentencing laws. And Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which is a national group of families and concerned citizens who are working to change these laws, believes that the punishment needs to fit the crime. And even in federal murder cases, judges are mandated by law to consider the facts of the crime. But with the drug offenses, they're not.
I know that a number of federal judges are against the mandatory minimums because you don't need a judge anymore.
That's right. And basically, the entire judicial system is in revolt against mandatory sentences. The Sentencing Commission, which sets federal penalties for all crimes, most of the federal judges that are sitting and also some judges that have retired because they can't live with themselves because of the sentences they have to impose. And pretty much every criminal justice person that's working with the system sees the results that these mandatory minimums are having on the sentencing system and the prison system as a whole. When you look at the federal prison population, 61% are drug offenders. And a couple years back, the Department of Justice studied those drug offenders and found that 38% meet their definition, the government's definition, of low-level nonviolent offenders. These are people that have no criminal backgrounds. Most of them have families or, you know, were employed at the time of the offense. But because of the severity of the laws, there's no breaks. And these sentences are non-parolable. So the offenders, people like Kemba, are going to serve 85% of their entire sentence. And that's a lot of time.
Now, we interviewed Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, a while ago, and he said one of the reasons for the disparity, he turned it back to the Congressional Black Caucus, and he said that because of drugs ravaging various communities, that they originally, although have definitely backed off this now, wanted the, extremely stringent laws against crack.
Right.
Let me ask Gus Smith, father of Kemba Smith, what do you think about that?
I don't think that it should be any disparity between crack and powder. You need cocaine to make crack. So why should there be any disparity at all? And in from my position, it's not about crack being a powerful drug. It's an economic issue. If young people don't have any hope, if they don't have jobs, if they can't get a decent education, then they're going to do whatever they can do to survive. So we need to address, we need to start looking at the problem and stop addressing the symptoms, because we're addressing the symptoms. We're not addressing the problem.
How long has Kemba been in prison right now?
Kim's been in prison for 3 years. I mean, she has a he'll be 3 years old in December, a son that we're raising that she has not had the opportunity to read him a bedtime story or give him a bath.
And what is she doing in prison right now?
Kim, in prison, her actual job, everybody works in the federal system. She's the liaison between the college that assists the students with education, helping them get their books, their ads, their drops. She also writes people all over the country, encouraging them to look at their issues, to wake up. She's received over 3,000 letters from across the country from people thanking them for saving their lives, for changing their lives. She's done a tremendous job in terms of trying to turn this country around, trying to help the youth in this country. And that's a direct result of the kids coming from Ohio. This country really needs to take a look at where we're going with mandatory minimums to try to turn this drug issue around and stop treating the symptoms and treat the problem.
I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post today by Cortland Malloy, a column, and he describes the case. It's called, by the way, Awakened by Kemba's Nightmare. He says, according to a 16-count indictment filed in U.S. District Court in Norfolk in 1993, Hall was the leader, that's Peter Hall, the former boyfriend of Kemba. Hall was the leader of a violent drug ring that moved as much as $4 million in powder and crack cocaine between New York and Virginia from 1989, the year Kemba finished high school, to 1993. Wanted as a material witness in the case, Kemba was arrested and posted bond, but then apparently out of fear fled with Hall, making matters worse. She finally turned herself into federal authorities in 94, was held without bond. Hall was placed on the U.S. Marshals Service's 15 most wanted list, and later that same year was found shot to death in Seattle. Kemba eventually pleaded guilty to federal charges of conspiring to distribute cocaine. She'd ridden in a van carrying drugs from New York to North Carolina, money laundering, she had sent money to Hall while he was on the run, and lying to federal authorities. She had said she didn't know Hall's whereabouts. And then Anthony Graham quotes some of your students responding to these details. How did they respond?
Well, actually, the way the kids feel, they don't condone the actions that were involved. Their issue is with the harsh sentencing that she received for the minor role that she played.
And I think what brought a lot of the students to this issue is the fact that they can see in themselves, you know, how easy it was for Kemba to take a fall. And through the Emerge article, which did a very good job of not only explaining the facts of Kemba's case, but also how the federal sentencing system works, I think the students began to realize how the mandatory minimums are a real threat to America's youth today. If you look at the average offender age in federal prison, especially relating to drug offenses, I mean, it's usually happening to folks between the ages of 18 and 29. So in terms of sort of an intergenerational prison crisis, what we have here are laws that do not let the punishment fit the crime, do not provide any sort of second chances, and then basically consign young people to prison for the most productive years of their lives, where there is no rehabilitation and really no opportunities to better yourself or to create a career or to learn a career whereby you can come back out into society and become a working, taxpaying citizen. And that's one of the problems with the mandatory minimums, is that people, you know, it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction. We think that by incarcerating that we can get rid of the problem, but it addresses the problem on the back end, not on the front end. And without better education about the threat of sentencing laws, then we're just going to see more and more young people like Kemba going to prison for 5, 10, or 20 years or more. So it is a very big problem.
Monica Pratt is with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Anthony Graham, a teacher that's brought his kids in to rally here in Washington, D.C. from Ohio, and Gus Smith, Kemba Smith's father.
And Kemba would be the first one to tell you that she broke the law, as is written. But it's 24 years, the punishment that she should receive. Initially, when the writer of the article came to us and talked to us about doing the article, we were reluctant, meaning Kemba's mother and myself. to going public with this. And Kim was the first one to tell us, Mom and Dad, this is not about me. This is about helping other folks, other young folks, to prevent them from going down the same road that I went down.
Gus Smith, what about the support you've gotten? I mentioned this rally today where Maxine Waters will be, Congressman John Conyers, Congressman Bobby Scott, Dick Gregory, and a number of other people, NAACP. What kind of support have you gotten for Kemba's case?
We've received tremendous support from all over the country. There are schools all over this country that they read the story to the students in churches. Churches rally behind us. Also, the letter writing campaign that we've initiated. We've had a lot of corporations, companies to come in and say, "Well, you know, what do you need? What can we do to help?" Contacts being made. We speak at universities, churches, telling young folks about the story to prevent them from going down the same road.
What about in Congress? Are there laws that have any possibility of passing right now that would change mandatory minimums?
It's a possibility because Congress will be, if they're not already, looking at proposals from the president or from his staff in reference to the laws. Now, I'm not sure exactly where that stands right now, but hopefully today we can have some impact.
Monica Pratt, do you know what's happening right now in terms of Janet Reno and her advice on this and the disparities between crack and cocaine sentencing?
Well, in the last year, there's been a lot of debate about the issue, and everyone's weighed in, from the Sentencing Commission to Drug Czar General McCaffrey and a number of other people. And basically what it gets down to is, as you said earlier, that crack and powder cocaine are sentenced 100 times differently. It takes 100 times more powder cocaine than crack cocaine to get the same sentence of 5 years in the federal system. So that means that 5 grams of crack cocaine at this under current laws gets you a 5-year sentence. 500 grams gets you a 5-year sentence. Now, these cases also relate to conspiracy cases, and one of the reasons that Kemba's sentence is so severe is because she was sentenced under the existing crack penalties for her involvement in this large-scale conspiracy. Currently pending, there are a number of proposals. The most important is Representative Charles Rangel's bill, which does seek to equalize crack and powder cocaine. And what that would do is it would allow the base sentences for the two substances that have been found to be the same to be equal. But then under the federal sentencing system, enhancements could be given in association with other offenses in addition to the drug crimes, meaning that if you committed violence and associated with a drug crime, if you sold it near schools, if you used school children to sell drugs, you know, if you possessed a weapon, all of these different factors could be factored in. And not on the base level in terms of what the actual sentence for crack and powder is, but as additional factors. Because powder cocaine trafficking is also a dangerous business, and it takes powder to make crack. So continuing disparate sentences for both powder and crack cocaine doesn't make sense when you really think about the issues.
Monica, what is the website and the phone number of the Families Against Mandatory Minimums who you work for, the group you work for?
Our website is www.fam, and that's FAMM.org. And you can get more information on FAM and the work that we're doing or on this rally by calling area code 202-822-6700. And just briefly, the rally is scheduled to be held from noon until 1 p.m. on the eastern steps of the United States Capitol. We do have a rain date or a rain location, and that would be room 2226 of the Rayburn House office building.
Well, Monica Pratt, I want to thank you very much for joining us,
as well as
Anthony Graham of Colonel White High School, has come to Washington, and Gus Smith, father of 24-year-old Kemba Smith, in prison on a 24-year sentence. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And as we said yesterday, we're going to bring you the end of our interview with Julia Alvarez. I met Julia Alvarez a few weeks ago up at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, one of the most prestigious writers' conferences in the country, outside of Middlebury, Vermont, where writers gather from around the country to talk and learn about writing. Yesterday, we talked with her about her book, In the Time of the Butterflies, about the Mirabal sisters, the four sisters who rose up against the Trujillo regime. Three of them were killed by Trujillo on November 25th, 1960. Julia Alvarez's father had also fought against the Trujillo regime, and ultimately they were forced out of the Dominican Republic and came to the United States. I talked to her about what it meant to come to this country.
For us, it was such a shock then to come to land in the in a country where the language is different, people are different. I mean, it was just like the loss of everything overnight. And that certainly was true. I mean, there was nothing that was the same. And I think that that was a real, I think that's a watershed moment for all of us in my family. And different ones of us have done different things with it. I think I would never have become a writer unless that had happened to me. I was not a kid. I was a very active kid. Probably the kind of kid you would put on medication if you're growing up in this country, one of those hyper kids, you know, just a real tomboy, not good at school, not a reader because nobody read. I mean, I didn't come from a literary culture or family. It was a storytelling culture, a folk culture, oral culture, but books, we didn't have books in my house. Reading and writing, no way, you know. So I think coming to this country and being suddenly on the margin and not understanding and not encountering a very friendly environment, especially at that time, still, you know, basically the 50s in 1960, drove me to a kind of interior resources that I might not have called on in a place that was where I could just spread into the culture and feel a part of it.
Julia Alvarez, author of In the Time of the Butterflies and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, will be back with her in a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with novelist Julia Alvarez, author of How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, Yo, and In the Time of the Butterflies.
When critics talk about you as a great Latina writer, a great Dominican writer, how do you feel about that? Do you find that confining or do you say that is who you are?
Well, it always depends on the context of who's saying it. You know, I mean, I think I'm very much come out of my culture and my roots, and I don't want to deny them. I am Latina. But I want to be, you know, I strive to be part of the membership of the American writers, along with Emily Dickinson, along with Faulkner, along with Sandra Cisneros, along with Amy Tan, along with, you know, I don't want to just be sociology, a great Latina writer. Let's read this writer to get a sense of Latinos. Hey, let's read this writer to understand the human heart better. And the characters happen to be Latinos, just like, you know, Faulkner's characters were Southern. Emily Dickinson's poetry came out of the hymn books of New England. We write out of our cultures and out of our roots, but not just, you know, as a confining set of themes that we can deal with, or a confining readership that we are addressed to. Or a limited number of themes. We're writing about human beings, you know. So it depends on who's saying it and how they're saying it. You know, if it's, this is where she comes from, these are her roots. Or if it's, oh, you know, here's another interesting Latina writer. Let's look at, you know, this new literature. What new literature? You know, let's look at this literature.
I wanted to go back for a minute, Julia Alvarez, to the family you had in the Dominican Republic, if it is as it is and how the Garcia girls lost their accent. You talk about how particularly your relationship with your mother was more difficult in the United States because you had this extended family in the Dominican Republic to be a cushion for you, and suddenly you were put into the nuclear family. Yeah. Now, in the Dominican Republic, you were in a kind of compound with all your aunts,
well,
uncles, and cousins.
Well, that's in the book. I mean, that's the fictional family. That's not my family. You know, I wanted to, for the purposes of the story, I wanted to create a kind of family that is found there, that kind of really heavy-duty, upper-class family. My family was more complicated, and we weren't assembled that way, but we were in close proximity to each other. And we were, which this is definitely different from this country, we were raised by la familia in general. I mean, we were, you know, my aunts had as much say as my mother, and there were lots of niñeras, and, you know, there were tías and godmothers and tías that had never gotten married and lived with us, and my grandparents. And I think that, for me, that was, I think it's very helpful. It even makes probably nuclear family stronger to be embedded in that kind of system, because you don't depend so hard and fast on just the few members. And so it takes a village to raise a child. You know, a lot of people raise you. A lot of people raise you. And so I would, for instance, I had a tía who understood me and, you know, me comprendía and could talk sense into me, which my mother didn't seem to be able to. So whenever they went off, you know, for a weekend or went off on a trip to the north where part of the family still was, they would take me with them, and I was with my tía. So there were different nurturers, and I think also the fact that there were niñeras. I think my older sister has analyzed our commitment politically to the downtrodden, in that really the people who would pick you up many times and hold you and console you if you scraped your knee was the niñera. Those were the mothering figures. Those were the ones who you bonded with in a daily way.
You're talking about the maids,
yeah,
to put it
maids.
Bluntly, the servants.
Yeah, the niñeras that we had.
Jumping around a bit, in your book of How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, you talk about how, there was this figure, this guy from the CIA, who worked with your father, actually set him and others up to overthrow Trujillo. Mm-hmm. Is that actually true?
Well, that figure is he's completely invented, and the whole drama of it, as it's set up in the book, is different from the way it exactly happened. But according to my father, they were contacted by the CIA because at that point they wanted Trujillo gone, and they promised them it's a mini Bay of Pigs. They promised them ammunitions, and then decided that there wasn't the time, that they didn't know quite if these underground members could be trusted, because maybe. So they withdrew and didn't deliver the guns, but people—it had already gotten started that there would be a coup, and that's where people started to get arrested and seized. And actually, the CIA person that helped my father, and even we think helped keep my uncle alive, who was arrested later and was in the torture prisons for about 8 months. That guy is. Came to my reading in Miami when I read there, and he wasn't an American, he was a Mexican-American, Manuel Chavez. And I said to Manuel, he came and he introduced himself, and then I still have the letter he wrote afterwards. It's 5 single-spaced pages where he tells everything about what happened, how the decisions were made. That letter, I made copies, and it's gone around the whole familia. Everybody knows Manuel Chavez. You know, I mean, that I've made the contact. Papi and him have talked on the phone, because Papi still credits him with, he's the one that he was unwilling to leave these guys in the lurch, and he helped them to get out. But he couldn't, you know, he couldn't get to everybody. But he really felt conscionable. And this guy, it turns out, I said to him when I met him in Miami, I said, Manuel Chavez, you know, I have a very dear novelist, compañera, Denise Chavez, who's from Nuevo Mexico, New Mexico, is his niece. So I call up Denise, I said, Denise, if it weren't for your uncle, I wouldn't be here. I couldn't believe it. But so it wasn't a victor, you know, it wasn't the Tiobik in the novel, and it wasn't exactly that way, you know, as it happened. But these, see, in a way, of course, my story is like the story of the Garcia family, because that's the story that was happening all over Latin America, of the, you know, CIA and the Americans trying to topple these regimes and pulling out and not being sure and who could they trust. That happened over and over. So it would happen in a way. Yeah, the reason that the Garcia family, you know, springs from, in fact, my own family, is because the story is the story, you know, of what happened in so many of these places. And so my story is just, you know, one of the ones that went to feed into what then became the fictional story of the Garcia family.
We're talking to Julia Alvarez, novelist and poet. Her three novels are Yo, In the Time of the Butterflies, and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent. You continue the story of the Garcia Girls in Yo, although Yo is it's your third book. It's a different kind of book, but it starts off with Yo, being short for Yolanda, but also, I guess, that's I, right?
Well, it's playing with, because this is what the whole book is playing with, you know, what is that shifting shoreline between fact and fiction? And is this Yo, this I, Julia Alvarez, or is Yo what each of the storytellers, the who tells the story on Yo, is saying, Yo, what about me, you know? So it's playing with the fact, what's fact, what's fiction. It's also playing with who gets to tell the story, who gets to be the I in the story.
Well, that's very interesting about this book, and that is that Yolanda, the second daughter in the Garcia family, she never actually speaks in this book. It's everyone else speaking about her.
Yeah.
But it starts off with the sisters, your sisters or Yo's sisters, being very angry that in her writing she has stolen their stories. And I guess this would be the problem, a common problem among writers, that you are taking people's stories.
Boy, that is the topic of so many discussions here at Breadloaf. You know, how do you do that? You know, what are you allowed to do? And what about libel? You know, what about yesterday we had a workshop. Don't you feel guilty when you do that? Somebody was asked, another novelist who was conducting a workshop. And, there's so many answers, I don't know if that's the proper question. I think in part I wrote Yo because I don't know what the answer is. I write books because I don't know things, and I want to find out. And not that I find out by writing the book. You know, Chekhov said that the task of a writer was not to solve the problem, but to state the problem correctly. So I'm interested in what the challenge is to the storyteller. I'm also... in some ways a believer of the idea that the truth will set you free. I came from a dictatorship that censored people. I came from a culture where women were taught to keep their mouths shut. I'm, you know, in terms of different third world cultures, I'm very much in that model of Maxine Hong Kingston, who starts her novel, Woman Warrior, by saying, my mother told me never, ever to repeat the story. Horrible things will happen if your story, tribal story, gets outside to the enemy, you know, to the other. So there's almost an atavistic keeping of the secrets entre familia, inside the tribe. So the minute you become the storyteller in a place like the United States of America, where we're all a bunch of others here, even though people try to say something different, you're going outside the group in a way. So there's a betrayal is perceived as a betrayal of your little regionality and your little close group. But if you don't do that, then the United States of America doesn't have your voice as part of its culture. You remain isolated and marginalized, which is what the group is fighting not to be. So, you know, all these pulls of the storyteller, you know, and I believe that the truth will, I don't believe that the story I believe the word is good. I think it can be misused, but I think that the story is how we take care of each other as a tribe, all of us, not just my group of Latinos or not just the Afro-Americans. It's the story that connects us all, how we take care of each other. And I believe that so firmly that it takes me through some of the storms of people who are disapproving because they have a personal issue with you that wasn't resolved, or because of their own vanity, or because of their own fears. And if you are also, because you are also not just a storyteller, not just a writer, but a human being with people you love, then you have to make these kinds of trade-offs and balances. And sometimes you take something out because it's just going to be too devastating to a person who can't take that being in your book because they feel that it's somehow too connected to them, or you tone something down, or you put it aside and you know you're going to publish it at some later point when it's, you know, you do this, you have to do this. Some people, like, you know, Faulkner, or was it Faulkner who said that Hamlet was worth any number of little old dead ladies? In other words, you have to be ruthless and just publish, who the hell cares? I can't be of that camp, you know. But that is another camp, you know. To hell with it, you know.
Well, in your book, Yo, the older sister of Yolanda says to her, when she's so upset because her sisters don't want to tell her that they're having babies or anything because they're afraid of becoming fodder, the fodder of her books, she said, if Shakespeare had felt that way, we wouldn't have had Hamlet. And I'm glad we have Hamlet, even if his mother wasn't.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, that so often with my own sisters, they'll say, oh, you have to read this book. Oh, you know, it's just like it could have been us. And I think, yeah, right, you know, I'll read it. And I say, if I had written it, they'd kill me, you know. So it's part of it. It's just because they know you personally. They can see little threads. And if they see something that's sort of like them, they'll say, oh, so that's how she really, they think it's like you're making a statement on them, or you're trying to expose them, or something, you know, that makes them feel uncomfortable. Because they see the little pieces. And I think that's hard when you're in the family of a writer, because you see where little things come from. But what are you gonna? What is the story gonna come from? But the context of your life.
Was your writing hardest on your mother? Telling the secrets of the family.
I think probably. I think the writing was the hardest on me. Seriously, I didn't publish Garcia Girls till I was 41. And, you know, I remember it coming out of me wanting suddenly to call the publisher and say, I'll buy every copy, even if I have to work for the rest of my life to pay you. Take it away. You know, I've come, you know, from a culture that's very 19th century, and I knew the implications of my writing about, it didn't even have to be about things that might be like things in the family, but things like, you know, women having lovers or sex, because if I was writing about it, I must have known about it. So all of that, you know, so it's a complicated position to be a storyteller. And I think all of my friends who are writers have experienced it to some degree. My friends who are from so-called, you know, other cultures or marginal cultures or minority cultures, where there's been that glue of, you know, your people and your familia, even more so.
In your father, or Yo's father, this dilemma is presented to him, and he seems to be the most sympathetic, even though a lot is told about his life, about his daughter writing. Could you read the end of Yo, where your father, or Yo's father, says he'll give a blessing?
Well, sure. And this is, you know, this is a wonderful feeling for a storyteller, to feel this blessing of someone who understands what story is about, whom they also love, you know, saying, tell the story. So this is at the end, the father.
This is Julia Alvarez speaking, and she's about to read this prayer from her father and from the father in her books. But we're going to leave you hanging and play that prayer tomorrow on Democracy Now! As we'll end our two-part interview with Julia Alvarez, author of Yo, In the Time of the Butterflies, and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent. I spoke with her at the Breadloaf Writers Conference in Breadloaf, Vermont, just a few weeks ago. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York is our engineer in Washington, D.C. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!